Welcome to the Free Cities Podcast. My name is Timothy Allen, and this is the official podcast of the Free Cities Foundation. Hello, and welcome to episode number 63 of the Free Cities Podcast. Well, sitting here with the sun streaming through my window, one could imagine that maybe spring is in the air. It's obviously not, but I can but dream. It's about to get worse for me. In just over a week, I'm off to Mongolia, where I'll be walking 150 kilometers across the Altai Mountains with a Kazakh family. Last year, it got down to minus 38 centigrade at night, so I think I'd better enjoy this warm spell here in the UK while I can. Anyway, back to the important stuff, and today's show is for the Bitcoin curious amongst you. Remy Fort is a film director who created what I would call, I suppose, one of the most influential Bitcoin films ever created. Certainly it's true if you're using the metric of eyeballs, at least. His film, The Satoshi Mystery, in French, of course, it's Le Mystère Satoshi, has been viewed more than 8 million times, and most likely much more, if truth be told. It's very hard to quantify those kind of things beyond a certain point. It's a six-part film series which, in my opinion, explains the why of Bitcoin very well, using interviews and documentary footage and a narrative unveiled by an animated Satoshi Nakamoto character, who is, of course, the pseudonymous creator of Bitcoin. Well, I spoke to Remy at the Bitcoin Film Festival in Poland. Links in the show notes for that. And we go into the importance of the cypherpunk origins of Bitcoin and why it's one of the most important tools for freedom in these current times of burgeoning states, oppressive central bank digital currencies, and social credit scores. You can watch the full film for free on YouTube. Just search Le Mystère Satoshi, and there's a six-part playlist on one of Art's channels. That's A-R-T-E. It's a French channel. Thanks for listening, and I would like to ask you a quick favour before I go. If you like the pod, we would very much appreciate a review on your podcasting platform. Just pop over there now if you've got the time and hit the star button or whatever it is. And don't forget, you can reach out to me through any of our social media channels. We're even on Nostr now. And if you don't know what Nostr is, then you better look it up. It's Nostr, spelt N-O-S-T-R. And I will see you there. Of course, in the meantime, you don't need to do any of that if you don't want to. You could literally just sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Remy Fort. We were talking about this in the last podcast. I would say I'm a voluntarist. Do you have any particular, are you political at all?
Yeah, but I rather keep it to myself.
Sure,
if you're okay with that.
Yeah. It's of no importance to me at all, you know, but it's interesting. Would you say you're a Bitcoiner though?
That's complicated. Sometimes I am, sometimes I'm not, you know. I'm really... did the interview started?
Okay. I don't do a start and finish, don't worry.
All right. So I'm more in it because it's a technological breakthrough first, and then I was kind of fascinated by the disappearance of Satoshi. The fact that something so revolutionary was created by someone who just vanished, or by a group of people who just vanished, just fascinate me. So I came into Bitcoin through this door, And I stayed because in some ways I really like the culture and the people around the Bitcoin. And we were talking about memes earlier, and I think memes are a big part of the Bitcoin community and the Bitcoin culture. There is a culture, and it's really interesting to see it developing in real time, you know. So yeah.
Well, it's interesting that you you've made a very extensive film about Bitcoin, but you wouldn't call yourself necessarily a Bitcoiner. That's interesting.
But we should define what is a Bitcoiner, you know.
Well, I would say myself, I advocate for Bitcoin.
Mm, okay.
That's really what it means for me.
Yeah. Okay.
And I do heavily. I've studied it for many years. I've been part of the community for many years. And I see a future in which many problems are solved alongside the adoption of this particular type of financial infrastructure.
Okay.
Basically. So, yeah. That would be my definition. What's your definition?
Okay, I guess I'm a Bitcoiner then.
Okay.
No, but it's just some ideas that are in the Bitcoiner community are not really, you know, I do not relate to some of the ideas, and so I you know, I question myself. And I think I'm more of a filmmaker first, who found a really interesting topic and we'll just stick to it.
So let me, first of all, your film, I watched it again last night at the cinema. It was good to see it on a big screen, actually.
Yeah.
It's a completely different experience, isn't it? I forgot. I can't remember the last time I went to the cinema, let alone to see a Bitcoin film. I mean, I've watched a lot of Bitcoin films on my laptop over the years. I don't think I've ever seen a Bitcoin film on a big screen before. But fortunately, your film is quite high-end production anyway. A lot of Bitcoin films are, you know, some of them just making it on a small budget. I'm going to go ahead and anticipate there was a pretty good budget for the film. It has things that I know as a filmmaker are expensive, like animation and this kind of stuff. Did I get this correct? Where, just before the film started last night, someone in the crowd was talking quite loudly.
Yeah.
And they said that it has 7 million views.
Across platforms and across countries, yes. Because Arte is a European channel, so it was broadcasted in many different countries. And then the DW, a Dutch channel, bought the rights as well. And they made a few edits, but then I think we were at 1.5 million with the DW as well. So yeah, we are about 7 million,
I think. Well, I think even on YouTube it's got more than 2 million views, isn't it?
Yeah, the French version of the series has 2.6 million. And then you have... it was broadcasted also on Arte.tv, but I don't have those numbers, so... Arte told me that there were 5 million views across platform, and then with the DW, I just, you know, added.
Well, I'm going to go ahead and say that it's the single most watched Bitcoin film of all time, isn't it?
I don't know. Yeah, maybe.
Well, it must be. Like, who are the contenders? Like,
Dustin Hoffman, do you know him? Cryptopia and... the Rise and Rise of Bitcoin, I think.
Right. But that's a very old one, isn't it? That's one from back in the day. It's a good film. That's the one where you see the journey of this guy mining on his GPU miner and doing all, you know. He ends up spending all his Bitcoin on mining equipment, doesn't he, at one point?
Oh,
The Rise and Rise of Bitcoin.
Yeah. I think
that's one of my favorite films. But I'm pretty sure 7 million views must be... Even if it's not the most, because it's hard to quantify, I would say it is the most. So it's probably the most influential Bitcoin film that's ever been made, then.
Maybe. Okay, yeah.
Okay, well, that's good. I'm not going to downplay it.
I'm a bit shy, so, you know.
No need to be shy in this.
And I don't have the true numbers right now, so, you
okay.
know.
Okay, but it's better than... like, for example, if you look at Bitcoin films on YouTube...
Yeah.
They don't get anywhere near 2 million views, not in the slightest, you know. And so you, this is, I think this is important. I'm going to tell you my my synopsis of the film, because I expect everyone gets something different from it. Mm. And I'm interested that you came at it from the... Basically, it's a film centered around the synonymous personality of Satoshi. And Satoshi appears in sort of comic book form, which is really nice. And I almost felt like throughout the film, Satoshi has a bit of disgust for the real world. Have you noticed? He doesn't like what's going on, right?
Yeah.
And he doesn't like what people are doing with Bitcoin either. Mm. Was that your own take on it? Did you decide that that's what Satoshi thought? Or did you know?
That's a good question. You know, we tried to, as we were thinking of making a fictional character who goes through a fictional story, we decided to characterize him. So we took the stereotype people usually have about Satoshi. So a man, probably in his 50s, living in a big city, and you know, I thought to myself, okay, this guy like to work, he like to code. Bitcoin is it's a lot of work, you know, to do by yourself. So he doesn't have a life. And maybe he's good with that, you know, so maybe he's kind of like a misanthrope, you know, he doesn't really like going out or talking to people, I don't know, it's a nerd, he is a nerd. So yeah, that was our beginning, and then I built everything around it. But it's, again, it's really, it's fictional, it's my vision, it's not... Yeah, I doubt we will.
No one knows anyway, so...
Exactly. And I think that if we knew, we would be really, really surprised.
Or disappointed, possibly.
Or disappointed, maybe, but, you know, yeah.
Well, that's the interesting thing about Satoshi and why the whole story is so incredible. And I think you get this across well in the film, of the importance of the fact that we know nothing about Satoshi.
Exactly.
Can I ask you first, when you came up with the idea of making a film based around Satoshi, did you know about many of the concepts behind Bitcoin, about what it is, about CBDCs, about all the things you touch upon in the film?
I found out about a few things along the way, because so I started to get into Bitcoin in 2017, and it just blew my mind, you know, like... everyone. And then the fact that Satoshi was missing also blew my mind. So I wanted to make a movie that would mingle the two things. And then it took a long time before Arte greenlighted us. So almost 2 years. And during those 2 years, I had quite a lot of time to keep in touch with the Bitcoin community and to learn. So, you know, I was in the rabbit hole for 2 years before making the movie. And blockchain technology, CBDCs, Libra, everything happens between 2017 and 2021 when we first started to shoot. So, yeah. But I had, before we went to Arte, I had a pretty good knowledge of the technology behind Bitcoin and about Satoshi and about all that, yeah.
Well, let's start at the beginning then, because this is something that I think a lot of people don't know about with regards to Bitcoin, is the roots of Bitcoin in the cypherpunk world.
Yeah.
And it's probably one of the most important aspects to get your head around, because most people approach Bitcoin from a certain place. But if you approach it from a cryptographic way and the cypherpunk way, you realize what it is as a technology.
Exactly.
You realize why it exists.
Yes.
And it's a freedom technology. It's a technology to free people. That's my interpretation of it. Would you agree?
Yes. Yes, of course.
Right. Which is why it's super relevant in the kind of circles that I revolve in. And tell me what you know about the origins of Bitcoin in the cypherpunk world, the most interesting aspects of it that you discovered making the film.
The cypherpunk were a group of individuals that really interested me because they knew before, anyone had the internet, or, a bunch of people had it, but they knew before the world that everything was going to change. And that's something I think is incredible. And so they started to build these tools to keep freedom on the networks, PGP, BitTorrent, things like that, to continue this utopia that internet was at the beginning, as that has been diverted by big tech and maybe states, I don't know, and so money was on their list. It was something they wanted to make for a really, really long time because they understood that if all of our transactions were digitized, it could be a huge problem. You don't know who can find your records and everything. So, and the most interesting thing is that they struggled for like 10 or 15 years because there was this double spending problem, and for a storyteller it's gold. When you have this objective which is so clear, and the path to get there is really complicated with a lot of obstacles and everything, it's gold to me. And then Satoshi arrives and he just compiled a few technological things that were invented by others, and it works. It just works. So, and it's still there, 14, 15 years after, it still works. So yeah, that's it. And as for the cypherpunk, I wanted the viewers to really understand, why is there a Bitcoin out there? Why Bitcoin, and so it was really important for me to explain that, that bunch of people were afraid that freedom could be jeopardized. And so they built things, and Bitcoin is a tool to fight for freedom on the electronic age.
And interestingly, this is the last quote in the film. Says exactly that. What is it? Freedom can never be taken for granted. We are her champions.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm. But, that was a nice way to end, but I probably shouldn't be talking about that. We're at the beginning of the film here. I agree. Understanding the origins of Bitcoin, yes. Super important as to the why of it. And I think if you miss that, you're missing a lot of the connections that you can make further on down the line about why are you using Bitcoin? Because, I've known about Bitcoin for a long time, and I've known about cypherpunks for a long time. But watching the film again yesterday, it reminded me that it did. It was like a refresher course. Going, yeah, of course.
Cool.
It really was. I was reminded at why. Even though I know all this stuff, it's important.
And it's most of the people who say Bitcoin consumes too much energy, Bitcoin is useless, etc. They don't see the point of it. They don't understand why it is there in the beginning. It felt really important for me to start with that.
Well, exactly, and in fact. Just before the pandemic started, I was in the process of making a film called Proof of Work with Richard James in Australia. Do you know Richard James? Anyway, I had 40 hours of interviews done with Bitcoiners and stuff, but the pandemic put a stop to it. And actually, by the time it could have got going again, I felt like it was almost out of date. Quickly the Bitcoin...
Yeah, 1 week in the Bitcoin community is like...
Right, okay. But... that's exactly the conclusion I came to making the proof of work film. The idea was to convince people why proof of work was necessary. Yeah. Because at the time there was a huge amount of backlash to Bitcoin, saying it's too energy intensive. Yes. And I agree. If you value Bitcoin, you don't care. If you don't value Bitcoin, you say it wastes energy. And yes, it's as simple as that. Yes. And every, you know, so you have to show people why it's valuable.
Yeah, exactly. If you value Bitcoin, it makes sense, you know. If you don't know, okay, it's an ecological nightmare, I guess, you know.
Yes, but I mean, and, you know, this is a whole other story, but no, correct me if I'm wrong, because I've watched so many Bitcoin films in the last 2 days. Do you go into the energy intensity of it? Or is, oh, no, this Machine Greens was on just before yours,
yeah,
wasn't it?
I've seen
right,
it, yeah.
Which is also a very good film.
Yeah, like, exactly.
Okay. So according to you then, the primary why for Bitcoin is freedom, or are there any other aspects that you sort of discovered during the process?
Of course, you have the economical reasons. You know, Satoshi wrote a great deal, but not a great deal, but he wrote a few things about banks and everything. So you have that, but I don't think it was their main objective. No, I think it was really freedom and fix the money, fix, you know, came after. But that's what I think. What do you think about that?
Well, yeah, but you, I mean, one of the other things you mentioned quite heavily at the start is privacy, which goes hand in hand with, obviously...
Sure. Sorry, but for me, privacy is freedom. So, yeah, I didn't...
A lot of people wouldn't make the connection between privacy and freedom. Like, arguably... Some people would say, well, if you've got nothing to hide, why do you need privacy?
Yes.
You're free. Mm. You can do whatever you want. Go on, talk about the connection between privacy and freedom.
It's really interesting because I, before starting to work on that project, I wasn't seeing privacy like that, you know. And the writings by Eric Hughes or the Crypto Anarchist Manifesto really... open my mind about it, you know. So yeah, I think that everyone should have the right to disclose what they want and to keep for themselves what they don't want. It's as simple as that, you know. And that's what is said at the beginning of the Satoshi mystery by Satoshi, and it's actually a quote from one of the manifesto. A quote from Philip Zimmerman: "A secret is what you don't want I don't remember the quote exactly, but
a secret is what you don't want the world to know, or something. Is it something
yes,
like that?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah. So it comes from something Philip Zimmerman, who created PGP, wrote, and I think it summarizes really perfectly what privacy and freedom have in common, you know?
Interestingly for me, I just noticed that the word secret even has a negative connotation. Mm. Is that right? Does it in French as well? And secret,
un secret.
Secret, yeah.
Yes, I guess if you have something to hide, it's not really well seen, you know.
Yeah, which is a strange concept.
Yeah.
But, because as we're discussing here, there's absolutely nothing wrong with not revealing yourself to
exactly.
people.
Exactly.
Because it's true, like me revealing anything to you is absolutely up to me. And...
Yes, of course, but on the other hand, if you have a secret, you know, I want to know about it.
Sure.
You know, I don't know what it is. Maybe it's a threat towards me. I don't know. So I think it's in the this curiosity is in human nature. You know, so yeah, maybe we just you know don't publicize that we have secrets. We just
don't say
yeah.
anything.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but like you say, just in a normal human interaction, you're going to wonder if someone's not revealing themselves to you, you're going to assume there might be something nefarious going on or something unusual or something dangerous.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. But I think also in France, there is kind of this romantic conception of secrets, and it's... sometimes it's there is this sentence that it's good to have a hidden garden, and not to to disclose that. And we kind of admire people who are good at keeping secrets and who have a lot of them. I don't know. Yeah. So it's, you know.
Well, I think, I mean, talking of secrets, your film pivots around the most incredible secret that has been kept in the, I mean, arguably in the history of the world. I'll elaborate here. Currently, Satoshi Nakamoto, the inventor of Bitcoin, will probably be one of the richest guys. He is one of the richest guys in the world. He has access to a number of, over, was it 1.2 million Bitcoins?
Yes, yes. According to some research about the pattern.
Right. Yeah. So this is a person or people who have access to such an astonishing amount of money, yet they are choosing not to spend it. Now, that's quite an incredible feat in itself, let alone, I mean, I can understand why Satoshi wouldn't want to reveal himself.
Of course.
That makes absolute sense.
Yes.
Right. But that, unless he's got some other Bitcoins that he's using.
Or maybe he don't need it. You know, maybe he's rich.
Already rich.
Yeah.
Do you have your own theories on Satoshi?
No. I think it's a group of people, but I really don't know. You know, and I try to stay humble about this because nobody knows, you know. But regarding the stash, I think that it would make sense that Satoshi just burnt everything that could have connected him or her or them to the creation of Bitcoin. So I think that, you know, maybe in 2010, 2011, when he decided to disappear, he just burnt it. And it was not that big of a deal at that time.
You're right, actually,
but
yeah.
Now, we don't know. Maybe it's a person who have regret about it, but who can't do nothing about it, you know?
The romantic inside me would say he doesn't regret.
Yeah.
But I agree. As a cryptographer, he knows, or she, or who they know, unequivocally, that if they just burn the private keys, there's absolutely nothing they can do. So you wouldn't even think about it.
Exactly.
You wouldn't be able to regret it, even.
Yeah.
Well, you wouldn't, because you know there's absolutely nothing you can do. Regret, a part of regret for me, is thinking you could change the outcome. Right?
Yes, but people change, you know. Maybe now they want to be famous, they want to be rich. We don't know. It's been 15 years, so, you know, I don't know. It's my storytelling perspective. I don't know.
Maybe.
I want to have drama.
Yeah, well, I think the whole of the Satoshi story has got plenty of drama in it. And actually, it's only just getting going when you think about it. And you touch upon this in the film. In the part about CBDC, central bank digital currencies, which there's a whole section of the film about blockchain technology.
Yes.
Right. Mm. And I like the way you spoke about it, actually. Mm. It could have gone one of a number of ways, but
yes.
Tell me about blockchain technology then.
That's a really interesting question, because I was when I was making the film, I was kind of convinced by blockchain technology, you know. There was all these articles about blockchain, we can put cars on blockchain, we can put you know, food on blockchain, everything. And so I was really sincere at first. I interviewed a guy who worked for a big company that tries to implement blockchain in other companies, etc. And as I was, you know, studying it, I realized at one point that there is no use case, actually. And it's too complicated and it's too expensive. Just make a regular database, you know. You don't need a blockchain. Bitcoin need a blockchain. And so I thought it was really, really funny. And by the time we were, you know, shooting and editing in 2021, the blockchain hype was over. So it just, yeah.
Well, I mean, it's still the hype about blockchains in general is over. But alternatives to Bitcoin, which claim to do something different using blockchain technology, is very much still alive. And I know. I think you tackled it very well, and in a true journalistic sense, you went in with one idea and actually decided to change on account of some new information. So, according to you, then, if Bitcoin is the only real use of blockchain, what is Bitcoin? You know, why can't a supply chain company use blockchain, for example, so that to track their goods? You know, what does Bitcoin need to be to be using blockchain in a very good way?
Bitcoin needs to be to everyone. It's a common good, you know. It's and you don't have to question it. It's there, you know. It's like the air you breathe or something. And the difference with a company that would use a blockchain for a supply chain is that there is a centralized, you know, point. So you don't need a blockchain. Blockchain, I mean, is for decentralized use only. And I really think that, you know, I'm kind of a maximalist because of Satoshi's disappearance. And I don't think that you can recreate the genesis of something like Bitcoin. It's over. It has been done. So you don't need to recreate it over and over again. You created it. It's Dan Held who said that. You don't need to recreate digital scarcity once you've created it, you know. So I don't know if I answered your question.
No, I mean, you could ask 1,000 people what is Bitcoin and you'd get 1,000 answers. I think from my perspective, digital scarcity was an innovation. And I agree, you can't recreate it because people know what the creation process is now of digital scarcity. And people would act differently.
Exactly. Because back then you didn't know if it was going to take off, you know?
Yeah.
So nowadays, if you were going to say, okay, I'm making a cryptocurrency, I stay pseudonymous or whatever, but people are going to, you know, jump in and buy your coin.
It's happening already, obviously. It's happened 8,000 times since...
Too many. Too many times.
Too many times. But no, I think it's worth pursuing the point of blockchain and why blockchain is not necessarily important in anything other than Bitcoin. My take on it, obviously, is, like you, decentralization is the important point about Bitcoin. The fact that it has no leader, the fact that it has no central point of, you know, attack.
Yeah.
And blockchain's an intricate part of that. There's no question about
exactly.
it. But other than using it as a way to transfer value, anything else that uses blockchain that doesn't connect the real world with the digital world in the same way is useless. Like, take the supply chain example.
Yes.
It's all very well
yes.
tracking goods on a blockchain, right? But how do I know that the goods and the data on the blockchain are connected?
Yes, like, of course. And I was really, you know, baffled by this, because when I was interviewing that blockchain guy, I asked the question of oracles and all that. So you need to trust the people that put the data into, you know, your blockchain. So that's something which is really problematic.
Right. So you just said it there, trustless. You have to trust someone. So we could probably posit then that trustlessness is a core principle of Bitcoin. And anything that doesn't have trustlessness is not important in the sense of Bitcoin, which, in my opinion, is designed to separate money from state. It's as simple as that. Otherwise, and which is the same thing as decentralization.
Yeah.
The state being central and Bitcoin being decentralized, which is why your part on CBDCs is very important. Maybe you can talk a little bit about CBDCs, which are central bank digital currencies.
Yes, so the interesting thing that we wanted to tackle in the Satoshi mystery is that Everyone, seeing the success of Bitcoin over the years, tried to take it. So you have first people creating altcoins, then you have big companies trying to create digital currencies. And then you have states. States are like, oh yeah, blockchain technology, it's really good, and we should put our currency on a blockchain. And it's actually, and it was really, really interesting in a storytelling perspective, that the things the cypherpunk were the most afraid of was going to happen. And it was a bit because of Satoshi, you know, because he got blockchain out there. So he kind of gave ammunition to Eric Hughes, who would say faceless and giant corporations and states and, you know. So yeah, that it was really interesting, and it was kind of the reason that we wanted to make the film, actually, because everything is going to be digitized. You know, we are in a already virtual world, and money is next. It's coming. You know, and people are not yet seeing the importance of privacy, of data, of that kind of thing. And it was really one of my goals to give the tools to understand what is at stake. I didn't want to orange pill anyone. It was just, okay, here is what's happening. We are living in a more and more digitized world. And here is Bitcoin. You know, and it has been created because of this. So
I'm wondering whether during the process of this film, of making this film, you started trying to warn people about the future as Satoshi was himself or herself, himself, themself. At the beginning of the film, you kind of make that point quite strongly that he knows what's coming, as did any cypherpunk, who were very technologically savvy people, way ahead of their time. Knowing what we know now, I mean, I'm an average person and I can understand what's going on, but they understood it as they were creating the tools to
way before. Oh yeah, everyone.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but everything they said is actually coming true. Is that
yes,
right?
Yes. Everything. I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. So warn me then, or warn me about the future.
That's kind of an interesting question, because sometimes I'm optimistic and some days I'm really not. But
well, presumably there are two sides to this coin now.
Yes,
one is optimistic and one is pessimistic. Bitcoin is, in my view, Bitcoin is optimistic. Central bank digital currencies is pessimistic.
Yes.
Depending on who
yes.
you are.
Yes, sure.
If you're a central bank, you'd see it the other way around.
But what I really like about Bitcoin, it's like it's a bulldozer, you know. It's a machine that won't stop, that you can't stop, and that it's going to outlive us, I think. That's my opinion. And so that's, it gives me hope, you know.
Yeah. Talk about... I'm going to ask you about the the ins and outs of a central bank digital currency. What makes it different from Bitcoin? What makes it similar to Bitcoin? Why is one or other? Why are you optimistic about one and pessimistic about another? Or even just tell me what you're optimistic about and tell me what you're pessimistic about.
About CBDCs?
About anything. to do with...
In general?
Well, to do with I think they're all connected, you see. I don't think you can think about the future without thinking about money.
Yeah, and of course not.
That sounds shallow. I don't mean like how much money you've got. I mean, what is money?
Yeah.
I think it's the most fundamental question you need to ask yourself about society to understand where it's going. in this age, at least, and probably forever. It's just that right now, it's scaling on a dramatic scale.
Mm.
Really, the technology is scaling so fast. It's very easy to predict a change because it's all happening so quickly.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
I see what you mean, yeah. Yeah. About CBDCs, I don't know all of the projects precisely. So I don't even know if they use blockchain. You know, I guess some of them are.
I'm going to go ahead and say yes. Yeah. I don't 100% know, but I'm pretty sure that's the point. You know, that's the difference between, because let's face it, you know, currency is digital now already. So what's different about a CBDC? Yeah, it's issued from a central bank rather than whatever. But I think blockchain is the thing that makes it slightly different. But I better check that. I'll put it in the show notes.
Yes, I would be really interested in that. I think a documentary should be made about all the projects of CBDCs around the world. But I want to take your question on the Bitcoin side. You know, what I like about Bitcoin is that, you know, you can use it to cross borders without too much fees. You can use it to send a payment to anyone without being stopped. So that's what we were saying. It's trustless, it's permissionless, it's borderless, and it's decentralized. And all of those things are not in the CBDC agenda, you know.
100%. They're almost the opposite. It's a permissioned, certainly. I mean, you only have to think like a government to know what they're going to be like. I mean, how does a government treat you in daily life? Okay, that's how they're going to treat you in your digital monetary life. Permissioned. Probably, and, you know, we can move on to this, but my observation of it shows me that what CBDCs also empower in governments is social credit score systems. Mm. And that's the really scary part of it all, because that is governance scaling. Currently, if you're an authoritarian government, for example, you need people to enforce your governance. So you need a lot of people on your side. And arguably, this is why a lot of authoritarian governments fail, because they can't get enough people to enforce their rules. What's interesting about central bank digital currencies and technology as it stands, you can create a governance model, which is an algorithm.
Yes.
That regulates people. So on your phone, you have a score, your residence score out of 10. The higher your number, the more access to things you get.
Yes.
The more access to society they get. The lower it is, the less you do. And the algorithm decides what makes it go up and what makes it go down. And that's a governance model that can scale, as far as I can tell, indefinitely. Because you could be one person running the network.
Yes.
And as long as the network stayed intact, everyone is regulating their behavior inside this network. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's possibly the end game of this kind of centralized version of Bitcoin technology.
Yes, I think that this kind of Black Mirror episode is not so good for people. It's not so.
Well, you do touch on what's happening in China.
Yeah.
So, what did you discover about the way that the Chinese social credit system works?
And when we made the movie, it was only on an experiment in a few areas, and I think it's developing way more by now. And but what I'm interested in as well. So you have the privacy and freedom aspect of things, But I'm also interested in the currency kind of battle, you know. We live in a world where the dollar is really powerful. And now, if you are the first to make a CBDC that can compete with it, and that is, how can I say it, but really advanced, it's like, I don't know, some kind of war. A war of currencies, but yeah, sorry, I'm just
I agree.
Lost here.
It's not easy to comprehend, possibly. I think I know what you mean. The race to create CBDCs is currently a race for the reserve currency of the world.
Yeah.
And as the issuer of the reserve currency of the world, you basically rule the world. It's as simple as that. America currently holding that, or the Federal Reserve holds that title at the moment. And as a result, America can invade Iraq with no problem because they have the reserve currency at their disposal. They can just decide, right, we need $1 trillion to invade Iraq. Someone at the Federal Reserve kind of, and I'm simplifying things here, but obviously, but presses a button and suddenly $1 trillion appears. And the reason that doesn't cause a hyperinflation event is that because the dollar's the reserve currency, all that liquidity gets soaked up by the rest of the world. I mean, in the end, you would assume, yeah, it might hyperinflate like all fiat currencies, but currently it has the largest market for users of any currency. And in many places, it's mandated. And in, I think, you know, in many industries, it's mandated to use the currency.
Yes.
So currently, the CBDC race is a race for that title. Is that fair to say?
I think, yeah, among other things. But I'm, you know, I'm quite optimistic. That's strange, but
wow.
I don't think it.
You're optimistic.
Because I don't think it will work.
Okay.
Actually,
good.
So
tell me why. You mean the CBDC idea won't work?
Yeah. But that's just what I think today. So, you know, I think like in Europe or in France, for instance, when I see the strikes and when I see the protests about recent reforms, I think that people will always fight for their freedom and their, maybe not their privacy right away, but for their freedom. So, yeah, I'm kind of optimistic about things, and I think that Bitcoin is going to grow as well and offer an alternative to people. So once it is used by enough people, it's okay. It's, you know.
Here's something we were talking about the other day. How do we mitigate the chances of Bitcoin going the same direction? If Bitcoin does go in this direction that you're just alluding to, how do we stop it going the same way that gold went? As in, people start using derivatives of Bitcoin and we end up in a situation where a central authority claims ownership over those derivatives, let's say, starts issuing them, and then they issue as many as they want. So we end up in a situation where
the US have a
derivative of Bitcoin that they can print freely.
Yeah, but Bitcoin is this alternative system. So people, I think, will realize that we don't have to use this alternative system like the old systems, you know. And I think that's what's really interesting about our times is that we are challenging a lot of things, not just money. And Bitcoin is part of that. And I don't see why we would recreate an old system if we have a new one. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well,
but maybe I'm wrong, you know, maybe it's going to be...
well, it could be that people don't understand that. It could be.
But I think when you need it, You know, when you have a reason to use Bitcoin, like you need to send money to your family in another country, or you have problem with your state or with your bank or whatever, you eventually get Bitcoin. You know why it exists and how it is used. You know, and why it is used.
So, in other words, it's a question of waiting until everyone understands why they need it, which is ironic currently because it's in places like Venezuela and, you know, Argentina and Lebanon. This is where people are getting it slowly but surely.
Yeah.
And probably where we are, my country, I don't know about France and certainly America, we're not really getting it because the need is not there.
Exactly, yeah. We are always discussing it and viewing it from our point of view. But if you go in Africa, if you go in South America, and if you go in Vietnam, it's just, you know, another perspective.
One of the episodes is a six. I should probably mention this is a six episode,
yes,
program.
Yeah,
it's like it went. Each episode went out on TV each week. Was it?
No, the whole series was put online in, you know, one shot.
Oh, okay. One of your episodes, number four, is called Money, Money, Money.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that's what we've just kind of talked a little bit about that. And this is where I felt Satoshi's disgust the most, where he was looking at the world of, well, our world, not the world that needed Bitcoin, but the world that doesn't need Bitcoin, and seeing that people were misunderstanding his or her creation. Is that a good... Did I get the film right?
Yes,
in that respect.
Yes,
okay,
totally.
Right. So, what was his main problem? What was his main issue?
Okay. So again, as a fictional character, he wanted to solve a problem, which was privacy and freedom on networks, and all that people were talking about it and thinking about was getting richer or, you know. And so I was wondering, what would Satoshi think about it? You know, what would he think about all the altcoins? What would he think about Bitcoin just going up and up and making some people millionaires? And this episode you are referring to is really like a key episode, because Satoshi is wondering, should I come back, you know, and just take control to fix things, or do I just let go? And it's the again, from a fictional point of view, it's the moment where the character is forced to let go of something he created. And I thought it was interesting in a storytelling point of view.
Well, what I've just realized listening to you speak there is you're describing the same story of, although it had a different outcome, of Jesus going into the temple to turn over the money changers' tables. You know this story?
I'm not so familiar with it.
No, well, I'm not hugely familiar with it, but from what I understand, but I mean the character of Jesus saw the temple, which is Bitcoin, and inside the temple were money changers instead of people, I don't know what, glorifying God or whatever. You know.
Yeah.
And he went in, instead of, he came back. He went in there and he turned the tables and caused a ruckus and kicked them out.
Yeah.
But it's the same. I think the sentiment might, I think possibly you could say the sentiment's the same.
Sure, but I think it's also a human nature thing. You know, we as creator, for instance, when you create a documentary or a book, a movie or something, at one point you need to let go of it. You know, you need to broadcast it, publish it, and it's a bit hard, you know. What are people going to think? What are they going to do with it? Did your message really went, you know, so...
Or in my case, I just never like what I produce. Never.
Oh, really?
Especially in films. In photography, it's different because I can get very specific about the perfection of a photo.
Yeah.
But in a film, there are so many elements. It does drive me insane many times, and I to the point where I don't even like making films anymore.
Oh,
I like this. Right, this is great. This is talking with you on a microphone is so simple. It's so zen. We're talking about the same. We're still communicating. Your film is designed to communicate. This is a communication. Mm. We're talking about the same thing, but here we actually get to be imperfect. I'm trying to learn. I'm trying to listen to what you're saying and trying to move on. And
yes.
You know, and it's almost like when you've been involved in the spoken word long enough, the film world becomes just too intense. I've got to get the storyline right.
Yeah.
I've got to get the, even when you're making a documentary, I've got to tell it the right way. I've got to get the visuals have got to be good. And there is no end to how much you can perfect a film,
yes.
I don't think.
No. Just at one point, you just have to,
yeah.
You know, let it go, broadcast it because it's in a contract or something. And you just need to say, okay, it's not perfect. But at one point, I need to stop, you know.
But in Satoshi's case, you could argue it was important to let go because of the idea of decentralization
as
well.
Yes. And I think we underestimate how hard it must have been. You see what I mean?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think about the whole Craig Wright incident, and I think, imagine being Satoshi and knowing that if you just sign a transaction, he could have signed the Genesis block and said, and he could have put a stop to that instantly.
Yeah.
Which is for anyone that doesn't understand what I'm talking about, a lot of people won't. Somebody a while ago came out, a guy called Craig Wright came out and said he was Satoshi Nakamoto, and anyone that thinks they know anything about Bitcoin would assume he's not, just on his just general persona and what he says as well, which is often very un-Satoshi like, let's say. But one of the things he always said he would do to prove he's Satoshi is sign the Genesis block or one of the early blocks,
yes.
Which means he can prove that early on the Bitcoin network, there was only one person who was part of the network. It was mining Bitcoin, and that was Satoshi. And obviously, he's never done that, and we know that. But if, and this makes me think Satoshi probably burnt his coins, because I probably would have come out of nowhere and done that. Because this has been going on for a long time.
Too much temptation.
Well, it's been a very damaging part of Bitcoin's adoption. If you think about, you know, Craig Wright has, he's even been sort of threatening developers.
Mm-mm-mm.
And
yes.
Et cetera. You know, so it is actually having an effect on, I mean, I don't know how much, but for I think probably it's just more an annoyance than anything else. But
yes, but my opinion is that, okay, if I'm in Satoshi's perspective, if I want Bitcoin to be to have strength, to be solid, it must be able to overtake every challenge. And sooner or later, we would have had that kind of challenge. And we will. We have not seen the end of the challenges for Bitcoin. And the more it overtake. My English is getting worse and worse.
You're devolving.
Sorry.
Don't worry.
The more years are passing by and Bitcoin is overcoming every obstacle,
yeah.
the more it is, something that will last for a very, very long time, and that will work for a very, very long time. That's my opinion. So,
through making the film, what do you consider the strongest challenges it faces currently then?
Currently or in the past? Currently?
Currently and in the future. So currently moving forward. I mean, you may think there aren't any anymore. Maybe there's the major...
No, I think there is one. I think that if... But it's really hypothetical. The main challenge that Bitcoin would face, I think, is a lack of interest. If people just start to just, you know, not care about it, what is going to happen, you know, if you don't have because we need, I mean, Bitcoin need as much as developers and miners and users as possible, right? It's a network effect. And so what would happen if people just lose interest in it?
I think a lot of people have mentioned that. You could easily argue, though, that Bitcoin exists because of the current state of the world, for want of a better word. Mm. And unless that changes, Bitcoin will grow stronger. Yeah. It's an insurance mechanism against lack of freedom, really. And you could argue it will become less important in the future, I hope.
Yeah, I hope as well. I do hope that it will be used, but in kind of people won't even think about it. You know, it will be there. It will be part of everyday life, and we will just forget it and use it.
Well, yes, probably. But what that alludes to, and I'm always reminding myself of this, is that the Bitcoin movement is actually a freedom movement. And when Bitcoin is less important, the freedom movement will carry on. Mm. And that's what I think unites all Bitcoiners who actually care about it, mm. who actually, you know, want to make films about it, want to talk about it, want to promote it. What they're actually promoting is freedom. And Bitcoin is the current tool of it. Probably one of the most profound ones, because it's money, and money is just a, you know,
yeah.
There's another give it another couple of hours for that one, but
yeah,
that's a very long conversation. And in fact, I mean, we didn't talk about that. Oh, actually, no, God, I'm getting my films muddled up again. That was This Machine Greens was talking about money, and you didn't actually mention. Did you mention the concepts behind money and stuff in the film?
A little bit, but not that much. No.
Yeah, that would have been another tangent that you would have never recovered from. Probably.
It's complicated, because if you want to make a film about Bitcoin for no coiner or regular, you know, person, you have to explain computer science and money.
Yes.
And no, it's a bit too much. So,
have you got any plans to do any more films about Bitcoin?
Yes, I'm trying to make a film about the mining industry. I think that it's really important for people to understand what it is, why it is there. And I think a lot of people have a preconception about it. You know, you see these big farms of miners, and it's really not really clear for people what it is, you know. So yeah, I would like to.
Will that be in the same format as the Satoshi film? As in, will it have like comic book, cartoon type things in it? And
it will probably have kind of a fictional part. But you know, it's really early.
Who would be the protagonist in a film about mining?
I want to keep it a secret.
Okay. Who could it be? Let me guess. It could be an oil. It could be an oil man. It could be a Texan oil man.
I won't say a thing.
Okay, right. You don't want to give it away. Fair enough. Well, listen, Remy, I've really enjoyed this conversation. It's nice to speak into a filmmaker because, you know, I've made films and I'm glad you still think that making films is fun. I'm less so. Before we go, though, I've got one last question for you. If you had a 1 year sabbatical from your life, which was paid for, so you have a benefactor or you have a patron who's, you know, what would you do in your 1 year? Obviously, you can make films. You can go on holiday. You can do absolutely anything.
That's a tough question, but. I think that, you know, one of the things I love the most about being alive on Earth is to travel and to, you know, discover places and everything. So I think I would take my camera and go on a trip.
With the idea, I mean, come back with a film or not?
Yeah, I hope, but if not, just with memories.
Do you know what? It's interesting because the last actual... I mean, I've made lots of little films recently. Like, I made a film for Free Cities, but there's like 5-minute films. The actual last long film I made was exactly that. And it's not nowhere near a great film, but what it was... Like, I went to Mongolia with a friend of mine and we climbed Mongolia's tallest mountain.
Okay, right? Cool.
Over, well, it was about almost like a 6-week trip in the end. And we took some crappy cameras, some iPhones, a little DJI drone, and made the most honest film I've ever made in my life. And it's not going to win any, won't win any awards or everything, but that was that film. And when I look at it, I didn't have a storyboard, I didn't have anything. It just said, when you see it, you shoot it. And we cut it together into an okay film at the end. But when I watch it, I remember that year, and it's great. And it was the antidote to the way you have to make films. You have to reshoot another angle, reshoot that, do this, do that. There was no reshooting. If we missed it, we missed it. If my camera wasn't there, I'd pull a phone out and we'd cut it with footage of, you know, from Canon 5D Mark IV and an iPhone and a Ricoh and a whatever. And I did it and it was very useful. But funnily enough, since then, I don't want to make any more films.
You made the ultimate film. So.
No, I find the process very difficult. And I find it, and what I also feel I find hard is the delay.
Yeah, yeah.
It's very hard. Not only the delay in making the film and then putting it out, but the delay in, if you've got to find, you know, 150 grand to make a film, I think, it can take a year just to find the money.
Yes.
And in the meantime, you don't really, and then when you get to make the film, you're wondering, who's paying for this? Are they happy with the film? And that particular film in Mongolia, it cost me $10,000, the whole thing, including the edit, because the guy that I came with edited it. And I had paid for it myself, including all the travel, all everything, you know. It was an hour and 10 minutes long, and it cost $10,000, so, you know. But so you'd just travel. Anywhere in particular you'd travel in your sabbatical?
Places I've never been, so I think I would go to Asia, Japan, and maybe go back to the Vancouver area and the west coast of the US as well. I think that I would start with with these places. But
do you have a family?
Yeah.
So and you'd obviously take them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, sounds like a lovely plan, mate. Sounds like a beautiful plan. Well, listen, Remy.
I can't wait.
Yeah, okay, I'll write you a check now. All right, it was great talking to you, and good luck with everything.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me. It was a great conversation, and sorry if my English is not that good always.
Pas de problème.
Merci.